From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Harvard music professor Thomas Forrest Kelly says that Beethoven's Ninth Symphony has a unique place in Western culture. While the piece is usually enjoyed and performed standing on its own, Kelly says that to really understand it, you need to put it in the context of time and place. When the Ninth was first performed in Vienna in the spring of 1824 with its climactic Ode to Joy, the crowd had a very different expectation and perception of the music. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Professor Kelly about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony as a part of its own culture. In this way, he says, we gain a new perspective on an old friend. We invite you to join us today after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A lot of the times, hearing great music is an experience that stands alone, at least outside of a concert hall. Music can be transcendent because it's so completely personal. But Professor Thomas Forrest Kelly has spent much of his career giving music another perspective, one explored from the music's time and place. The Utah Symphony is performing the Ninth Symphony this weekend, so we're taking the opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation with Professor Kelly. He joined us to talk about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony as part of its own culture. Thomas Forrest Kelly, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure.
Well, let me start here first. I think one of the things you try to do, it seems, in your lectures and in your classes is put the music, the experience, in context. And I wanted to start from that perspective with this question. What did Beethoven want from this concert, the concert where he first performed Beethoven, his Ninth Symphony?
Well, I don't want to sound cynical. What Beethoven wanted was money and fame. That is, in his day, there weren't any regular symphony concerts. There wasn't any concert hall. There wasn't any standing orchestra that played symphony music. So it was his job to find a hall, get an orchestra, find a chorus, get some soloists, compose all the music, print the tickets, print the posters, get the people to do it, and run a box office. He did it so that people would hear his music, which he wanted them to do, and he tried to make some money doing it. This famous Ninth Symphony that was given its first performance in May of 1824 is something that has such a big sort of humanitarian message in it that I wouldn't be surprised if Beethoven really thought of it also as having a message for the ages. Hmm. But at the moment, he was trying to make a buck or a florin or something and put on a concert.
You've talked about how the Ninth has fascinated listeners and critics since its first performance. And I wonder if I ask you why, if that's an obvious question. That is, was it just the quality of the music or is there something else there?
Well, Beethoven's a great composer, and some of his other pieces are pretty famous. The Fifth Symphony has a pretty good track record, too. But this is such a gigantic piece, and it does have that sort of universal message, because this is the symphony that talks, as you know, the symphony that sings. It's the one where there are singers and a big chorus at the end. And they sing a song that's about joy, and it's about the brotherhood of mankind. We're not allowed to say it that way anymore, the siblinghood of humanity. And that's a message that we all need, and we never needed it more than we need it right now. So there's a timelessness to it, partly because of the music, and maybe because of its kind of enlightenment, universal message.
When did you first come to this idea of putting music in context, exploring these particular performances from the first night they were performed? When did you first come to that?
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, I've been a music teacher for a long time, and one of the things that I think is really important is to get people to understand how lucky they are to be alive on a planet that has music like this on it, and that they have all the equipment they need to not only to like this music, but to have their lives changed by it, if they have ears and a memory and a heart. So it's a kind of a missionary work, but it really started when I used to teach at the Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio. And my job was to run what they called a historical performance program for really for pre-professional musicians, but to try to get them to understand the concept of early music, that is, why you would want to play Bach on a harpsichord or think about what Handel's Messiah sounded like in its own time and so forth. So I devised a course for conservatory students that was about pieces that they thought they knew. And I called it First Nights. It's let's take these famous pieces that you think you know and love and think about how different they were when they were cutting-edge pieces of contemporary music, but for different people at another time. And that worked fine, but that was where we got down and dirty with the musical score and talked about all sorts of technical things. Then when I came to Harvard, and they really wanted some kind of course in Harvard's core program, and I sort of rejiggered the First Nights course so that I now teach it in the core program to people who are not pre-professional musicians. They're people who were taking their first and last music course anywhere. So we think about it differently. But I think when you take the famous piece of classical music down off of its pedestal and think about what it was like when it was a new piece of music, but for different people in a different place in time, it kind of comes to life. And we also learn things about things that we think have always been true about classical music, and in fact are things that we've constructed in our own culture, and the way this same piece of music operated for other people is pretty interesting. We learn a lot about the music and a lot about other people, but we learn also a lot about ourselves. So I think it's a great way of sort of dusting, getting the dust off of these museum pieces and making them into new music.
It's interesting. You seem very interested in this question. What was the difference in the expectation of an audience, say, in May of 1824, and the expectation of an audience who would go to see a performance of Beethoven's Ninth today? I mean, how fundamentally different would they have been, the audience then? I mean, I guess at its core, the basic element is they wanted to hear beautiful music. But was there something more was there something different? Was there something more accessible?
Oh, I think there's several things different.
Yeah.
Now, let's think about just two or three things that are different in general about music listeners in, let's say, May of 1824 and now. One is that, as I say, there was no regular orchestras or concerts or concert hall. You had to put all those things together individually. So a symphony concert was a fairly rare thing. And they were generally, what by our standards, probably under-rehearsed. It probably wasn't a great performance, the first performance, but that was the way they always did the few symphony concerts they were. So, and here's another thing. Beethoven's listeners much preferred new music. They would rather go hear the latest compositions of everybody than repeat performances of things, and we are completely different from that, it seems to me. We prefer, when we're going out to a piece of classical music, to hear something that we know. We want to hear a Brahms symphony. If we're going to go to the trouble of getting all dressed up, get in the car, go downtown, get a parking place, go sit in rows and listen to people, we don't want to take a chance on it being something we don't know. Here's a third difference.
Yeah.
People in Beethoven's day heard nothing but contemporary Viennese music. They knew that music up one side and down the other, I'll bet. They'd heard gazillions of symphonies, dozens of string quartets, all sorts of opera arias, but all by Beethoven and Haydn and Mozart and all the other people who were going around in Vienna. Whereas we have the luxury of listening to any music we want to from any time in history and from any place in the world. It's not a thing we would ever give up, but we can imagine that at least as far as hearing Beethoven's symphony, his audience brought a kind of local expertise that we'll never have. So there's a lot of differences between them and us, and they're probably worth thinking about.
It would a more proper comparison to be today, a piece, a modern rock concert, for example, than a concert where there's classical music performed. That is, these were people who wanted innovation. They wanted something on the edge, something a little bit more intellectually stimulating, those kinds of things.
And My students in my core course say, you know, I'm not sure I can take this course because I don't know anything about music. Hmm. You say, oh, yes, you do. You just don't happen to know about this music. But then I can play a lot of people sort of a half a second of some piece of pop music, and they say, oh, that's from the song so-and-so by the band so-and-so before the drummer changed and before they started being influenced by so-and-so. Yeah. You know, they have all the sort of musical, logical, and musical, historical information that's possibly available for that on the basis of 1 second. So they know that stuff up one side and down the other, and that might just give them a sense of the kind of expertise that Beethoven's listeners have. So, yeah, I think your analogy is exactly right, Doug.
As we we're going to talk about these particulars as we go along, but in general, what is the role of the Ninth Symphony? What role has it played, come to play in Western culture?
I think maybe the best-known piece of music in the world, or at least the tune in the last movement that we all know, which is used to sell Fords and which is used to, it's been made into a Protestant hymn. It's used for all sorts of things. Everybody in the world knows it. It's now the European community's national anthem. It gets performed as a New Year's event in Japan, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of times on New Year's Day every year in Japan. Do you know that the modern compact disc is the size it is? Because when the Sony Corporation and the Philips Corporation were sitting down to say, okay, we're going to make this new technology called the CD, how big should it be? And the Japanese side, the Sony Corporation, said it can be any size you want it to be as long as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony fits on one side of it. And it's the piece that... when the Berlin Wall comes down, that's the piece that Leonard Bernstein chooses to conduct as a celebratory piece. So, I don't know. It may be the most famous piece of classical music in the world. And I don't know. And I think it has a meaning beyond that because of its sort of unification message. Mm.
You've called it a milestone for later composers, but also a millstone. In what way is it a millstone?
Well, because Schubert, who said, who can do anything after Beethoven? I mean, Beethoven's symphonies as a package, and the Ninth Symphony in particular, which expands the symphony, the whole symphony genre, way beyond anything that had ever been before, makes it really hard to be the guy who writes the next symphony. You know, if you're, I don't know, you can be Clara Schumann, or you can be Hector Berlioz, or you can be a great composer of any kind, and you say, gee, what am I going to do for a symphony after this? It makes it a little bit hard. There are 19th century symphonies that obviously know this symphony because there's a bunch of other symphonies by Mahler and Bruckner, that have choruses in them the way nobody ever did until this Ninth Symphony came along. There are other ones that have sort of cosmic openings that let you know the way this symphony does at its beginning, that it's of titanic proportion and cosmic significance. And so it can't help but affect later composers, I think. Mm-hmm.
Thomas Forrest Kelly, he's the author of First Night's 5 Music Premieres. This weekend, Friday and Saturday night, the Utah Symphony is performing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. For details, visit us at KUER.org/Radio West or call 801-533-NOTE. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Harvard professor Thomas Forrest Kelly says Beethoven's Ninth Symphony has become probably the most famous piece of classical music in Western culture. But he says to really appreciate it, you have to try and hear it in the same way audiences did when it was first performed in Vienna in 1824. In this way, he says, we gain a new perspective on an old friend. Today in the program, he's with us to explain what his Ninth Symphony reveals about Beethoven's genius. Professor Kelly, tell us... give us a setting, Vienna, 1824. What's going on? I'm thinking of the you've written in your book that the French Revolution was casting a shadow over things. I mean, what's going on there that
well,
we should know?
Well, a lot of stuff has happened in the last few years. The French Revolution has happened.
Sure.
If you're the Emperor of Austria, you don't like the idea that. And you don't like the idea of all these Enlightenment philosophers, that individual human beings have certain rights and certain privileges and certain value. the kind of thing that the American Revolution and the French Revolution are about makes you very nervous. And so you continue to operate a pretty repressive society with lots of sort of secret police and informers and very strong Catholic authoritarian church. And which means that the only place that different social classes can gather is either in the theater or the concert hall, although there aren't concert halls, or in church. And then there's a huge economic collapse in Vienna, in Austria, so that a lot of the private orchestras that aristocrats had in their palaces had all collapsed. The great string quartet, Count Razumovsky's string quartet, for which Beethoven wrote some beautiful music, had disbanded. Count Razumovsky had gone off to Russia. Napoleon Bonaparte has conquered all of Europe, and then he's finally been defeated by the European allies and at Waterloo, and they have in Vienna this thing called the Congress of Vienna, where the powers of Europe get together in Vienna and decide the fate of post-Napoleonic Europe. Beethoven actually wrote a cantata, not a very good one, a thing called The Glorious Moment for the Congress of Vienna. And all of that's happened in Beethoven's lifetime and in the lifetimes of the people who go to this concert. So here we are in a much reduced Austria, still with its very authoritarian emperor. And Beethoven is a strong proponent of this idea that, you know, the American Constitution is based on, that the French Revolution was based on, that all human beings are endowed with certain rights. And he chooses this poem that actually all of his listeners would have known, this Ode to Joy by the poet Schiller. And he chooses lines from that poem and sets them to music as part of the last movement of the symphony. It's an unusual thing. A symphony is a piece for orchestra. It's not a piece for solo voices and chorus, and yet he puts it all together. And then he puts on a big concert. You have to remember that in May of 1824, Beethoven had been essentially stone deaf for several years. So he can't do what he used to do when he gave public concerts. The kinds of concerts he used to give were the typical kind of concert. They weren't called concerts. They were called academies. And an academy is a thing put on either by a composer or more often by a virtuoso performer. Mozart used to give academies, too. And in the case of Mozart or in the case of Beethoven or other people, you have a wide variety of music, including opera music, sacred music, chamber music. In Beethoven's earlier concerts, he would improvise at the piano. He would compose and perform a piano concerto, and he would have symphonies. Beethoven, in his day, was a very famous virtuoso keyboard player, and maybe in his earlier years in Vienna, more famous for that than than for being a composer. And he used to conduct himself. But in this concert, he couldn't play the piano because he couldn't hear, and he couldn't conduct because he couldn't really quite tell whether what they were doing was what they were supposed to be doing now. So in order to attract attention, one of the things it said on the posters that he had printed up was, Mr. Ludwig von Beethoven will personally take part in the leadership of the whole concert. What it really means is that he stood on the stage and sort of told the person he had engaged to be the conductor, Mr. Umlauf, how fast the various bits should go. But he'd had a couple of train wrecks in previous years when he was trying to conduct, so he knew better than to try that again. But it was a big moment because he hadn't given a public concert in a long time, and he was by now well into his 50s, which is pretty old for Viennese in those days, and he was pretty famous. So people did want to go hear what the composer that they were quite proud of had been doing lately. So he put on a concert that he claimed was all new music. It wasn't quite all new music. It started off with a piece that we now call the Consecration of the House Overture that he'd actually written a few years earlier for the opening of a suburban theater in Vienna. And then it had what the program called three grand hymns. But what it really was three movements of his titanic piece called the Missa Solemnis. But you're not allowed to perform church music on a public concert, said the censors, and you have to submit everything to the censors. So he said, this is my latest music. I really want to do this. There was a lot of begging back and forth. The censor says no, Beethoven says please, and they finally compromise, partly because he's famous. If you don't say it's a mass, if you just say it's hymns, then we'll let you do it. So he did three movements of the Missa Solemnis very hard, also music for solo voices and chorus. And then he finished the concert with the premiere of the Ninth Symphony. So it's essentially all new music, all really hard music, and all done on not enough rehearsals, probably not nearly enough rehearsals, for brand new music that nobody had ever seen before and a group of people who'd never played or sung together before. It's pretty amazing that he pulled it off, but it was probably pretty exciting to go to.
Well, I want to actually talk about this as we go along, the fact that this... I think in some ways it might be disappointing for people to know that the concert wasn't, in fact... perfect. There was a kind of anticlimax in some ways, but we'll talk about that as we go along. I want to get to the music if we could, and I want to play those first moments from the first movement. But first, set this up for us, if you would. You say that there's a kind of timelessness, something kind of spooky in these first moments, but would have signaled the Viennese audience that
Well, think about this. I mean, generally, symphonies, until Beethoven came along, symphonies were generally used as kind of curtain raisers or something to get the audience's attention. And you usually have some lively first movement, you know, that, and very often it starts off with some sort of a bang or something like this. This piece starts off in a way that lets you know this is going to be a very big piece. It starts off, listeners should probably turn their radios up, because it starts off with a kind of a sound like cosmic background, cosmic radiation or something. You don't know what it is. And then in this sort of black cosmos, you have these tiny little individual events, the smallest possible event you can have that has motion. Ba-dum. And then you hear another one. Ba-dum. And another one. So it's like little sparkles. I don't know, I think of it as little sparkles in a black background. And so, you don't know whether this piece is fast or slow. You don't know if it's major or minor. You have no idea where you are. And then Beethoven gives us a little composition lesson, because he loves to put music together out of many repetitions of a tiny little motivating unit. And what happens is these little things, which are sort of originally separate, get a little bit closer together. And then they get a little bit longer. Instead of going ba-dum, it goes ba-ba-dum. They get closer and closer together until they do finally coalesce into a melody, into a theme, and then we know where we are. But he assembles it out of a background of almost nothing. That's really pretty amazing.
Professor, you've called it the grand and solemn, and you hear something tragic in there as well?
I think so. I mean, now we know that it's in D minor, or at least we think the piece is in D minor. It's serious, it's solemn. Could it be a little bit march-like, a little bit pompous, but on the sort of tragic side? I don't know. I don't want to impute too much emotion to these things, but it does have a kind of an amazing beginning that only later coalesces.
I love how you put us there in your book. That you talk about the fact that in Vienna in 1824, performances began at about 6 or 7, in this case 7, that the rich people of town, it was a pretty, there was a lot of class in that society, I suppose, but they couldn't reserve their seats, so often they sent their servants.
Right. Beethoven, for this concert, chose to use the opera house, what's called the Kärntner Theater, which he rented. He tried another place, but he didn't get along with them very well, because they insisted on using their orchestra and their conductor and their singers. And he said, well, actually, I have my own people in mind. And in the opera house, for the opera season, you could rent a you had a box for the whole season that was essentially your living room, and you could live there. You play cards, you eat, you come to the front of the box if your favorite soprano is singing and that sort of thing. But for concerts, you buy entry to the thing, and the seats on the floor of the opera house was divided into two classes. Actually, there was a kind of business class and a tourist class, with the seats near the back being the sort of benches, kind of crowded, and there were benches in the front too. You could rent a kind of a back, like those stadium seats. Aren't there stadium seats that kind of clip onto the bench in the stadium that you can lean back on?
You could
rent those things, but because seats weren't reserved, just as you say, there was sometimes a big crush for things you wanted to get into. So the smart people, or the wealthy people, just sent a servant to go and buy a ticket and go and sit in the seat until you come, and then you sit where your servant was, and the servant goes home. It's something worth thinking about nowadays, at least for those of us who have servants.
You know, it's interesting whether or not they actually obeyed these rules. There were certain rules to a performance. Applause, you write, was limited by decree. You were forbidden to do encores, I suppose.
Right. You're not allowed to have encores. You're not allowed to have solo bows. You're not allowed to do. There are all sorts of things. The police commissioner has all sorts of rules about how you have to behave in performance. I suppose nowadays we are restricted more by sort of fire commissioners and police people who claim that what they're doing is for our own safety. But there were pretty specific rules. But it's also true, isn't it, that people make rules usually to control something that's happening, not to control something that's not happening. So when you see a rule that says no encores in the opera house, it probably means that there are encores in the opera house.
Right.
You know?
Well, you write that applause, and I guess this has always been the case, but applause for a Viennese crowd in the early 1800s was an outlet.
Sure. And, you know, I think if we went to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, we would know, because we've been properly trained by whoever properly trained us, our fourth grade music teacher or somebody, that you're not supposed to clap in a symphony until it's all over. So when each of the separate parts of the symphony, the different movements, as we call them, of the symphony, which is there are four of them in this symphony, as there are in most symphonies, there's this silence. But that's not the way it happens in 18th and early 19th century concerts, and it's not the way it happens in the opera house. When the movement gets over, if you like it, you clap.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you clap long enough, maybe they'll play it again.
Wow.
That kind of encore thing, you could get arias repeated, and you could get whole movements repeated. Apparently, there was a huge amount of clapping after the second movement of this symphony. The scherzo, Beethoven, you know, he flips the middle movements in a funny order. Usually in a symphony, you have the beautiful lyrical or contemplative slow movement coming second after the weighty first movement, and then you have the dance movement, the minuet. But Beethoven flips it the other way and puts the minuet in second position and the slow movement third. But it's not really a minuet. It's Beethoven's version of a minuet, what he calls a scherzo. It's kind of like a minuet on drugs or something. It goes really, really fast. Instead of going 1-2-3, 1-2-3, like a Mozart minuet, it goes 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And it's the piece that has that very cool kettle drum timpani solo at the very beginning. In the very beginning, kind of throws us off kilter because we think the rhythm is one thing. We think it's dum-ba-dum. But then he throws the timpani, and you realize that everything you thought was wrong. After that huge beginning, then we have a funny little fugue, a little entry, one voice after another. Everybody thought that piece was so cool that not only at the end of it did they clap really, really loud to try to get it repeated, but they actually also clapped for the kettle drum solos. You don't get many kettle drum solos in 18th and early 19th century music, and Beethoven really made a bunch of money out of this movement, I think. Could we hear maybe a little beginning of the second movement?
Of course.
Great. Yeah, there's that's a big explosion of the kettle drums that you don't really expect. There's a place later on, it's actually in the development section of the scherzo, where he switches it from this very cool rhythm to another rhythm, and he emphasizes the rhythm by having even more kettle drum solos, and they say that the audience really erupted. It might be nice if we were actually as enthusiastic about music as that. I think nowadays we treat going to a concert like going to church, if you know what I mean. We get all dressed up and we sit in rows, and then up on a platform are people who are even more dressed up than we are in old-fashioned clothes. If they wear like white tie and tails and stuff like that, it's the same way that a lot of ecclesiastical clothes are essentially medieval street clothes. That is formal clothes of a long time ago, and we have to sit quietly, and we know how to behave, and there's a kind of ritual, and we clap politely at the end, and then we go home. It lacks the kind of excitement and enthusiasm that it sometimes had maybe in Beethoven's day.
It's interesting that there's if you think about the protocol of some modern music, you know, a jazz concert, you do break in and you applaud for the, you know, for the bass solo or the drum solo.
Yeah, for everybody's solo, you clap. That's great. Yeah, and I think we should, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be telling conductors of symphony orchestras how their concerts ought to go, but it would be fun if we were a little bit more relaxed and a little bit more enthusiastic when we liked it. But the other side of that is that we need to have the right to boo when we don't like it.
Right.
So they've got to be prepared for that. If they want the audience to be enthusiastic, that coin has two sides to it.
But would they have booed if they were unhappy?
Sure. The Italians are even more famous for it. Anyway, there are people, travelers in 18th and 19th century Europe talk about how good the Italians are, even in church. The Italians are great at sort of blowing their noses and shuffling their feet in church when somebody does a particularly good solo or something like that, in places where you're not allowed to applaud. You make it very clear whether you like it or not. That is, you cough a lot if you want to drown out bad singing, and you shuffle your feet and blow your nose if you like it. That's a little side thing. Yeah. So Beethoven goes on then and plays us. Let's listen to the beginning of the what we call the slow movement, which begins with a kind of an introduction by the woodwind instruments to what key we're going to be in, and then a beautiful melody that's played by the strings one phrase at a time. And at the end of each phrase, there's a kind of an echo of that phrase by the woodwinds before the strings start the next one. It's something that people don't think they pay as much attention to this movement as they should. I think it's extremely beautiful.
You said you sense a bit of passion in the third movement.
Oh, I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Professor, you want to take us through part of this?
That's a beautiful part, but that's the second theme of that movement. We're well into it now, and it's a beautiful place that has all those sighs. But could we ever cue it up and go back in here just the beginning of that movement?
Sure.
Right.
We're looking for the beginning of the third.
Of the third movement, yeah. I want to hear that because it's going to come back again in a very cool place in the beginning of the last movement.
Is this it?
Yeah. Here we go. Here's the strings now. They finish their phrase, and the woodwinds echo, and the strings go on with their next phrase, and so on. It's like that. Even though those middle movements are in the backwards order, then comes the last movement, which is, I think, Beethoven writes on purpose at the very beginning of the last movement. Maybe it was just the opening few seconds, the ugliest sound that anybody ever heard.
And this is which movement now?
This is that last movement, the beginning of the last movement. It starts with just this uproar. Yeah. What is that? Well, actually, Beethoven's, and then the cellos and double basses start doing stuff. What I think is, actually, that Beethoven's listeners will have said, oh, I know what that is. We hear those in the opera house all the time. I think they will have said, this is a bass rage recitative. It's a weird accompanied recitative that normally in the opera house would be sung by a bass singer, and the basses are famous for raging. And it's the kind of piece you use when you're changing moods a lot. Usually in the opera house, you have one mood when you sing a song, and it's sad or happy or anxious or whatever it is. Mm. But occasionally in the opera house, when a person is so agitated that he or she is happy and sad and all sorts of things in quick succession, you use this kind of accompanied recitative. And what Beethoven is doing here, I'm convinced, and I'll bet you $1 million his audience knew just what he was doing. He's writing an instrumental recitative, and if we hear it, we can hear what it is. It's the cellos and basses, that is, it's a person, it's a voice, saying, I'm longing for something. I'm sort of anxious and in a rage, and I'm longing for something, and I don't know what it is. And if we listen through it, can we listen through the opening part of the movement? And I think you'll see what I mean. And if I can sort of talk over it a little bit, I think,
we'll start from the
top. I think you'll see what he's up to. Yeah. So, and here comes the singer. And there's the orchestra, big blast of orchestra. What are they saying? They're saying something. The orchestra says, well, what about this? Now, what's that? That's music from the first movement. That's how the symphony began. What's that doing in the last movement of a symphony?
Was that unusual?
And then this... Oh, yeah. Then the strings say, no, 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 not that. So then the orchestra says, okay, well, what about this? That's stuff from the scherzo. What's that doing in the last movement of a symphony? Oh, no, they say.
Is it playful, you think?
Well, sort of, but he's throwing in bits of the previous movements and they're rejecting them. Listen to this.
Yeah.
Oh, that's that beautiful theme from the slow movement. And the cellos say, nope, not that. They say, I'm longing for something else. You feel this sort of upward sort of surge of longing.
Mm.
And then... Then the orchestra, well... Something like this... Aha. And they say, oh, yes. Then we have something that sounds exactly like the end of a recitative in the opera house, even with a harpsichord plink, plink. Then comes the aria.
Would
so now what? Now you know what they're doing. Now they're playing the tune that we know.
Yeah.
And then we have variation after variation. So what I think Beethoven is doing is saying, the orchestra is speaking and it's saying, that was all very nice. That was nice, the first movement. That's not what I have in mind. That was nice, the scherzo. That's not what I have in mind. That was nice, the slow one. That's not. I need something else. I need something that's more joyful. And they propose something like that, the cellos say, yes, and then, okay, that's the end of the recitative, and then we have that tune. And as you know, we have many, many, many variations on that tune. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And just in case any dolt was there who wasn't used to going to the opera house and didn't recognize a recitative, when the orchestra gets finished with all of these different versions of that thing, that ugly beginning happens again, and a baritone stands up and sings the recitative. Oh, friends, not these sounds, but sounds of joy. And then the whole, the soloists and the chorus come and sing, and they have just a fabulous time singing a song that's about joy. Mm. And I think what Beethoven has done in there is somehow weave the whole symphony together so that it's not just a kind of psychological experience of four very pleasant, different pieces of music played together to make a kind of psychological curve, but really a single work of music that's really going to a single place, and the way of working in and rejecting pieces from the previous movements is something that nobody had ever done before, because it was always understood that you make the different movements completely separate. But he's trying to say, this is all one thing, and it culminates right here in this last movement. So he makes it a much longer and more complete and somehow more dramatic piece of music than anybody had ever tried before, I think.
Mm. Thomas Forrest Kelly, he's the author of First Night's Five Music Premieres. This Friday and Saturday night, the Utah Symphony will perform Beethoven's Ninth Symphony under the direction of Thierry Fischer. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This weekend, the Utah Symphony is performing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's giving us an opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation about the most famous piece of classical music in Western culture. Our guest is the Harvard music professor Thomas Forrest Kelly. One email as a question wondering from Sarah, who's wondering, which is the recording you prefer, Professor?
Oh, that's a tough question. I prefer one of several recordings. I use a recording by Sir Roger Norrington that came out some years ago for a couple of reasons. One is that he uses an orchestra of period instruments, and I'm interested in what Beethoven's symphony sounded like when it was new. And it was a time of sort of technological transition. They were still playing on old natural horns and natural trumpets. They had gut strings on all the violins, but people were beginning to invent new bows. There was a kind of a rotary valve that people were trying out on horns and trumpets. So it's an interesting thing. And another thing is that Sir Roger Norrington in that recording makes an effort to follow metronome markings that we have from Beethoven for the speed of the various movements and different parts of the movements, which are sort of interesting. People don't tend to pay much attention to that. People seem to think they have a better idea than Beethoven of how fast various things should go. So I'm not saying that Norrington gets it right and everybody gets it wrong. It's sort of worth trying, and I think it makes for interesting experimentation. But there's lots of great... I confess that I was raised on a recording by Arturo Toscanini, and he goes along at a pretty good clip, and the real heart of me, every time I hear any piece of the Ninth Symphony, I say, that's too fast, or that's too slow. But what I really mean is faster than the record I was raised on. And so I actually have Toscanini's tempos built into my hardwiring, I think.
You write about that evening, that the place was packed, that Beethoven actually got a haircut, which was unusual for him.
Yes. We know a lot about Beethoven's daily life in those days because he, unfortunately, was deaf as a post.
Yeah.
It was a terrible affliction, of course, for a musician, a performer, and a composer, and you wouldn't wish it on anybody. But he carried on his conversations by using a book. So you would go to Beethoven and write in the book, "Good morning, Mr. Beethoven," and turn it around towards him, and he, who could speak perfectly well, he would say, "Get out of here, Kelly, I'm busy composing my Ninth Symphony, I haven't got time to talk to you," or whatever he said. And because we have a lot of those conversation books, we know what he did and who he was talking to and what he said all during this period. And shortly after this concert in May of 1824, he was with Ignaz Schuppanzigh, the great big portly violinist, famous violinist, who had been the concertmaster for this orchestra, was an old friend of Beethoven's, and Beethoven called him Falstaff. He nicknamed him Sir John Falstaff. Schuppanzigh and Beethoven's nephew Karl and Beethoven were together, and Karl wrote in the conversation book, Sir John Falstaff praises the master who cut your hair. So we know that Beethoven had recently had a haircut right at the time of the concert, and there's actually a pencil drawing of Beethoven from May of 1824 that may actually show his concert haircut. I mean, I don't know if it has anything to do with the Ninth Symphony and how it sounds and stuff like that, but it's sort of rather nice to think that Mr. Beethoven, who is usually so slovenly, we know his hair was all flying in all directions, he attached enough importance to this, apparently, that he went and got his hair cut before appearing on stage.
I like how you say, you know, you write about the fact that there wasn't enough time for proper rehearsals. There were only three actual rehearsals there in the theater. And Viennese concertgoers weren't necessarily expecting a perfect experience. You write this. You write, they were not just listening to the performance, but they were listening through it to the music itself.
I think that's right. You know, I don't know about you, but the thing that amazed me the most the first time I ever went to a symphony concert was that all those violin bows were going up and down at exactly the same time. I remember thinking, how do they do that? Well, I bet in this concert they didn't do that. I bet everybody was sort of every band for himself, and people were doing the best they could. But that was the way they gave concerts. It was pretty standard to have a small number of rehearsals with a group that you assembled for the purpose. And if it didn't work, if people didn't like it, they wouldn't have kept on doing it that way for such a long time. So it must have been a standard that was satisfactory to people. And so I imagine that they must have been able, remember that they knew a lot of music and they'd heard a lot of concerts and they knew this style intimately, they must have been able to see what people were getting at in performances that never quite got at the perfection that we're used to. I think it might have made it maybe almost more exciting. I mean, nowadays we listen to these fabulous symphony orchestras that never make a mistake, and everything is always great. So you never get the sense of a tight wire act. Will they make it? Will it be okay? Will there be any terrible train wrecks that maybe make the performance a little bit more exciting?
Well, we're about out of time, but I did want to take a call from Elliot, who has a question, which I imagine will get us to the ode. Elliot, welcome.
Yes, hello. Boy, one of the comments of Professor Kelly sure caught my ear when I was driving in the car, and I couldn't wait to get home to call. You know, the brotherhood of mankind updated for political correctness. Wow, I was impressed. What did you say?
Well, it says, alle Menschen werden Brüder, you know.
Siblinghood.
But nowadays, we want to be as inclusive as we can. It's just hard to say all humans should be siblings and have it have that same ring.
Of humanity.
But we know what we mean, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, it changes through time, because I was going to comment about the historical environment in which a lot of these slogans, if I don't mean to denigrate these wonderful, you know, cultural things that come down to us after hundreds of years, most obvious is Thomas Jefferson's All Men Are Created Equal.
Sure.
Now know in that environment he should have said all Englishmen who pay taxes and own property are created, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
Hey, our Statue of Liberty, give us all your wretched and your forlorn and forsaken. I don't think that was the intention of the French who gave us the statue. You know, now we have Beethoven, you know, Leonard Bernstein. Was he there with the New York or the Israeli Philharmonics trying to, you know, mend the wounds of mankind, etc., with using Beethoven's Ninth, you know, at Berlin? So what I was going to say is that when Beethoven, I know a little bit, but I want to hear from you, though, to see how wrong I am or if I'm just off base. But when Beethoven did this brotherhood of mankind, he meant the warring tribes of Europe. You know, it was so idiotic that Saxons and French and Swedes and British should be fighting each other over all those interminable wars that Europe had, that I'm sure he didn't have the greater brother, you know, the siblinghood of the human race when he wrote
well,
that.
Well, of course, when he takes Schiller's poem, and Schiller's poem is actually, he doesn't set these parts of it, but it's written to be an imitation of a gentleman's drinking song, like what a glee club would sing.
Right.
So it does have to do with human companionship on a local level. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, maybe all politics is local. If you use those words in 1824, you couldn't help but think about the problems that the world you knew were having. And yet, I bet Beethoven wouldn't be surprised to find that that same message about universal brotherhood is pretty important in our own world, where we're not thinking about European powers, but we're thinking more globally. The problem is still there.
Elliot, glad you called. Thanks very much. And finally, I want you to lead us, if you would, Professor, up to the Ode to Joy, if you would, because I want to play this coming out of the program, and I want to thank you.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to be here. Let me just suggest that we listen to this one place where, after things have gone away, we've had all the ode, we've had it sung by the tenor, we've done all this stuff, we've had a funny thing with a contrabassoon and a little Turkish march. We have a little sort of development section. Then there's a place where Beethoven is letting us know that something is in our future, but we don't quite know what. But then it comes, like Old Faithful, comes boiling up, and we have the biggest and grandest version of the tune that we've come to love and that now I think of as the world's national anthem.
Thomas Forrest Kelly, he's a musicologist at Harvard University and the author of the book First Nights, Five Music Premieres. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.